Our next speaker is just getting his presentation called up. David Levy's well known to many of us, and his topic today is Eclipses as Inspiration, Using the Eclipse Experience to Inspire an Interest in Astronomy.
Thank you, and I wanted to thank Patrick for inviting me to come to this conference. This is actually the first conference that I've been at in quite some time, and it really is a pleasure to be here. And I hope I'll be able to see you all again at the next eclipse, which will be in about 3 days from now, but it's a total lunar eclipse. And I think a lot of us feel that total lunars and partial lunars and penumbral lunars and partial solars don't really count. What we really follow are the big total solar eclipses. And that's not quite exactly what the way I see it. When I say that I've seen over 70 eclipses, I need to say that those include the penumbral lunar eclipses. And I won't begin to say that I have traveled around the world to catch a penumbral lunar eclipse, but I have done considerable traveling to catch a penumbral lunar eclipse. I just love doing them. They're a lot of fun. I caught one that was just a little bit east of Tucson, so I got on a flight, an American Airlines flight between Tucson and Chicago, and I was able to catch the penumbral eclipse on the way. And it was extraordinary. And for me, in some ways, it had all of the magic of a total solar eclipse. I certainly can recommend them for any of you who are really interested in getting the entire eclipse experience. Eclipses as inspiration. In our title slide here, I'm showing you a picture of a solar eclipse over there on the far left, which is, I think if you look at carefully, the handwritten date on that picture says October the 2nd, 1959. I grabbed that picture out of the newspaper, and that is pretty much exactly what I saw that day. Observing session number one was on that date for me, and I remember chasing clouds to be able to do with my mother and my younger brother my first eclipse expedition to catch that partial solar eclipse. And then the middle picture shows me at exactly the same spot at the Westmount Lookout in Montreal, where I am watching a total lunar eclipse in 2003. And then just 6 months later, again at exactly the same location, seeing transit of Venus in June of 2004. The whole idea of being able to see events like this is precious to me, as I think it is to all of us, because it gives us the feeling, whether we are professional astronomers who have been in the field all our lives, or small children who are just being introduced to astronomy, it introduces the notion that astronomy changes, that the night sky is a changing show. It's not static. It's not just sunrises and sunsets followed by sunrises. It's something that changes all the time. I think some of you might have seen Wars of the Roses, the Broadway play, or Henry VI, Part One, where the first three lines in the play are astronomical. Hung be the heavens with black, yield day to night. Comets importing change of times and states, brandish our crystal tresses in the sky. I sure would have liked to know the guy who could write like that. William Shakespeare, in the work that I'm doing of the night sky of that period, has turned out, in my mind, to have paid more attention to events in the sky than all the other writers of his time put together. And as we look at this picture here, no, this is not the first organizing committee meeting that Patrick put together for this conference. But I think instead, it is King Lear banishing his youngest daughter and disowning his youngest daughter, Cordelia, because she didn't say that she loved him with the appropriate emotion. And I think somewhere in there, there's Gloucester, who is pleading with the king to reconsider. And Gloucester, being very upset after that, goes back to his home and has an argument with his son about the nature of eclipses. And it's hard to believe that Shakespeare devotes two full pages of King Lear to an argument about eclipses and their effect on humanity. And I think it's just extraordinary how they're able to do that. And Shakespeare might not have had a chance to look at this particular drawing that I received some years ago to find out the exact particulars of the total solar eclipse of October the 12th, 1605. In fact, Shakespeare would have even objected to the date, since I believe he was using Julian date rather than the modern Gregorian date. It would have been October 2nd, 1605. But there it goes, just south of England. It goes in the Gibraltar area and then through Barcelona, Spain. Just seems to miss some of the major European cities, but those same cities do get tremendous partial eclipses, including London, which got something like a 96 or 97% partial eclipse of the sun that day. I just love the idea of how astronomy was done back in 1605 or so. This is from John Dee, who was Queen Elizabeth's astrologer and her, in a way, her science advisor. And I love how he writes this. The distance of the starry sky to us is in semi-diameters of the Earth, 20,081 and a quarter. And then, this is from the Earth to all of the stars, everything. They're all the same distance. And then, in case you didn't quite get the number, he spells it out in words, 20,000, fourscore, one, and almost a half. We think we know a lot more about astronomy and the universe and eclipses and how things work now than we did in 1605. But we've lost some of the beauty and the majesty of how science was done back then. They didn't have it right, but boy, they had it beautiful. And just some examples of writers trying to explain how eclipses of the moon work, and diagrams, which they essentially got pretty accurately, although Ray, I think they didn't quite get that partial eclipse by the Arctic Circle as well, right, as you did. And obviously they didn't get a chance to see in a single photograph two-thirds of what we need in order to have an eclipse. The picture of the moon and the Earth in the same picture, taken from lunar orbit. I believe that's an Apollo 8 or an Apollo 11, but taken from lunar orbit. And then this picture, also of the Earth and the Moon, taken by Galileo as it's on its way to Jupiter, doing its second flyby past Earth and Moon. Eclipses is inspiration. Every opportunity that I have to inspire a child or an adult to look at the stars and to reach for the stars, I try to take advantage of that. I didn't have a teacher. In fact, people are talking about how much time we spend in elementary schools these days teaching science. I know it's some amount of time is spent, but in my time, the total amount of time spent in teaching astronomy was in fourth grade, and it was 10 minutes. It was the opening session of our geography unit, and they spent 10 minutes talking about the solar system. And I know they do a little bit better than that now, but I think they could do a lot better. But whether they give you 10 minutes to talk to you about eclipses and about the solar system and about what lies beyond the solar system, they are doing a lot more than we did back then, which was essentially nothing. But in both cases, what is missing is not so much the explanations and the ideas and the methodology of learning about the night sky. What's missing is the inspiration. I don't think it's all that important to take people and teach them about the phases of the moon. I think that if you can take a young group of people and show them that the moon is a place, that you can look through a telescope at the moon, and that even the smallest telescope, and you can climb up the lunar mountains and crawl into the craters. I think that's what I'd like to teach the next generation about the moon, that it is a place. It's a place that you can visit. Then the phases will come by themselves later. The other thing is that I've always tried to tell is lesson number one, write it down. I'm sure there are some people in the audience who have seen 16 eclipses and 16 total solar eclipses and haven't recorded a single one of them. I think it is so important to keep a record of all the observing that you do. And you might as well start now when you're young. And this is what I do with children, as I show them the page from my very first observing log with the code up at the top. And believe it or not, even though I devised that code when I was 10, I still use it. I have hardly changed it at all. It means I haven't matured at all in all those years. But that's kind of the way that I still record my observing sessions. And inspiring a group of my peers back then in eighth grade, if you'll notice, the planet that I'm pointing at happens to be Jupiter. And in the caption, it doesn't say that I'm announcing that there will be a cometary collision in several decades from now. But you know, that's what I'm thinking, maybe. Well, maybe. In 1963, I was down in Denver at the Jewish National Home for Asthmatic Children, and I actually missed a penumbral lunar eclipse on the 9th of January, 1963. I was watching the moon rise, and I do believe I recall thinking it's not really a full moon, even though that was the night of full moon, not realizing that there was a penumbral eclipse going on at that time. And also at that time, a most elegant little experiment that I tried, a friend of mine suggested it, and I tried, and I did it in 1963, and some of my cottage mates ripped up my work, and I never saw it again. So I repeated the experiment in 2003, hoping that this time I wouldn't find anyone to rip it apart. And all I did was every week I would watch the position of sunset. This does not require a telescope, does not require mathematics, doesn't require anything but a pair of eyes, a pencil, and a piece of paper. I drew the horizon, and I started when the moon was low in the south setting, and I just marked the position of sunset for 6 months, going all the way north and then all the way back south again. Did that for a whole year. It was something that taught me an awful lot about the Earth being a spaceship and the Earth being a moving object back in 1963, and it taught me the same thing again 40 years later. And also, if we're going to enjoy an eclipse, we might as well enjoy the bodies that cause the eclipse, particularly the moon. And I remember when I was very young, walked into the Montreal Center of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, our director of the observatory at the time, Isabel Williamson, presented me with a map of the moon for which he took a quarter, and then said, what you need to do is study this map. There are 300 features on it, 300 craters numbered 1 to 300, and 26 other features, letter A to Z. She would have said A to Z back then. Mm-hmm. And she said, all that I want you to do is to make your own map by observing every one of those 326 features and then writing them down. It took me 3 years to do that. Begun 12 September 1962, completed it on 26 July 1964. I actually finished that project, and this is a map of the best of that I copied years later. The original map is an unholy mess, and I wouldn't want to show it to you. But I had a lot of fun doing it, and I felt with every little feature, that I picked out, whether it be crater, mountain, or valley, or straight wall, it was like I was getting to know the moon better. I was getting to know the moon as a friend, and it began a friendship that continues to this day. Sometimes we don't get a chance to see things in the sky the way we want to. I hope this will not be the weather coming up on the morning of the 28th, but you never know. And also at some time when you're trying to get kids interested in the night sky, you're going to want to introduce them to a telescope. And I would recommend something like a very small telescope. A 3.5-inch telescope is really great for a beginner. I don't think you need to worry so much about the electronics. So you can go and get a used ETX or something like that. The electronics may no longer work, but the optics should be as good as they were when the day the telescope left the store. Or you could use this as a first telescope. This was built by the third Earl of Ross, and he finished it in 1845, and it became at the time the largest telescope on Earth and stayed that way for about three quarters of a century, till 1918. Actually, I think till 1917, when the Canadian, the Victoria telescope took over for a couple of months, and then the Mount Wilson 100-inch took over the year after that. But can you imagine this? They didn't have a NASA committee doing a site selection survey to find the best place in the world. No, he put it in his backyard in Ireland. And this is the Leviathan of Parsonstown. And what I did that night is I got a colleague of mine to take that photograph. The object in behind the right-hand wall is Mars, and so I think you can clearly say that you are right now looking at Mars through the Leviathan of Parsonstown.
Way of putting it.
And then there are the unexpected events. Eclipses are transient events which you look forward to and you plan for them and you try to get to them. But the unexpected events are just as exciting, and they're going to start in the next couple of years again. They're related to the sunspot cycle, and as soon as the sun starts to get more active again, we are going to be able to see more of these. And we get whether we look at the sky, the real sky, or whether we open a book and look at it, it can still have the majesty of someone who caught the passion of it. In this case, Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night. Always good to try to get the kids out of the city and to get them out into the country, as we do in this case, our annual Adirondack Astronomy Retreat in the Adirondacks, which we just completed a couple of weeks ago. We got three world-class nights that week where the sky was actually darker and clearer than it is from our home in Arizona, which typically gets much better weather. But we lucked out, and we had a lot of fun. It's a place where people can get together and relax, recharge, and figure out why they became interested in astronomy in the first place. I even got into astrophotography, my first astrophotograph in 1967. And then my second attempt to see a solar eclipse was the eclipse of 1970. As you can see by this photograph, I had less than perfect luck on that event. But it was still worth seeing, because here I am underneath the Earth's shadow, and look at this layer of stratus clouds, the darkest eclipse I had ever seen. You can see the edge of the shadow to the south over the Atlantic. But look how dark the sky got during that eclipse. It was the darkest eclipse I got until two Saros cycles later, when we had a total eclipse this last March, and the sky was almost as dark as it was back then. The only difference being it was a clear sky, and we actually saw the eclipse. First photograph of the moon. A lunar eclipse, a total lunar eclipse taken from our cottage in May of 1975. A total lunar eclipse taken in 1979, shortly, a couple of days after I moved to Tucson, Arizona to start my life there. Comet West. And the total solar eclipse of January 1979, seen from Winnipeg. We were assured at the National Council meeting of the RASC the day before that the eclipse was going to be clouded out. So when we saw that, that was quite a pleasant surprise, even more so when we saw that about an hour later. Just a beautiful, gorgeous, gorgeous eclipse. You don't need a teacher to teach you about the mechanics of a solar eclipse. When you see something like that, let the eclipse and let nature be your teacher. And I know that a lot of people have tried to take pictures that can match the visual majesty of an eclipse. And these photographs are absolutely magnificent, especially the one seen later this morning. However, they are not the visual view. That includes the sun, the corona, the moon, and the darkness of the sky around it. Absolutely spectacular events, and I think nature herself is the best teacher. A photograph I took of the 79 eclipse, just the scenery around totality. This is a picture that Roy Bishop took of an annular solar eclipse in 1994. And the picture on the left is an asterism taken at the same scale that my wife Wendy and I discovered during our comet search. It is a ring-shaped, almost perfect ring-shaped asterism of 11th to 12th magnitude stars. Just perfect and beautiful, so I call it Wendy's ring. So you can have eclipses almost anywhere you want. And Fred, thank you for letting us see the 1999 eclipse very quickly and very efficiently this way. Wow, you just saved a whole trip now. And I wanted to show you this picture as an example of how expensive it is to take pictures of an eclipse that are worth something. Wendy had essentially the modern version of an Instamatic camera, a film-based camera that she just pointed at the sun and shot during the 1999 eclipse, which had a totality where we were of about 51 seconds. The photograph includes the sun, the sun's corona, the moon, and the shadow. You can see both edges of the shadow as it's swinging around the sky like a giant second hand of a great clock. And so that shows that you can get it's almost impossible to get a bad picture of a solar eclipse. This is Roy Bishop's photograph of the same eclipse taken that day. And my viewing of the lunar eclipse of November, early November of 2003. And photograph, a montage of the eclipse of October 2004, taken a year later. The only thing is that the full moon over on the bottom left has been flipped. If you had a chance to take a look at that, you can see there was a little bit of a problem there, but I think it's artistic license. It makes the picture come out a lot nicer. And our time in Montreal to see the transit. I really wanted to see the transit of Venus from the same site that I saw my first eclipse. And it needed a clear sky in Montreal, and I wasn't sure that was going to happen. The forecast was perfect weather, but all that night before the transit, it was cloudy, and the clouds seemed to just be getting thicker and thicker and thicker. And I had already planned an emergency drive out to Ottawa, where the weather maps were showing clear sky. So I got up at 4 o'clock that morning. Wendy and I got into the car, and we headed down to pick up our friends, and we got to the corner of Atwater and Sherbrooke, 4 a.m., green light, no left turn, nobody's going to notice, I make the turn, and there is a police car sitting right there. And I thought, great, I'm not going to see the darn transit, and I'm going to get a ticket. This is not going to be my best day. And I look back, and the car didn't turn his lights on, and the officer inside didn't do anything. He was asleep. Maybe this isn't so bad after all. So I went and picked up our friends, and we went back. We went to our site just to see what it was going to do. And as we were there, we noticed that low in the northwest, there was a large area of clearing. And so I knew that that clearing area had already started to reach western Montreal. And so it was either going to be, we were either going to stay put or we were just going to head a few miles west to be able to see the transit. And by the time we set up our telescopes at the lookout, the sky, the huge areas of the sky were starting to clear, and we had no trouble seeing the last 2 hours of the event from that spot. By the way, if you take a look at that picture, there's just one little thing I wanted to point out about it. And one of them, and that is that everything that has taken place on our planet, every war, every Shakespearean play, every eclipse conference, every lifespan of every person, since the beginning of humanity, has taken place on a world no larger than that dot in that picture. And I just like that sobering thought when people say, what's so good about a transit of Venus? It's just a dot crossing the sun. It's a pretty important dot. It's not the Earth's as a dot, but it's a dot about the size of the Earth. November 2003, November, the eclipse in Antarctica. I really like showing this picture because I like to describe it as the last flight out of Antarctica for the next 6 months, as the long winter night is about to begin. And Wendy and I are sitting there, and we're not going to be able to get out, and we're going to have to stay there for 6 months. But fortunately, if you look in the other direction, there's a big crowd of people. And that big crowd of people is watching this. And that crowd is also watching that. And this is a partial solar eclipse. I saw this eclipse in 1986. I've always wanted to see it. It was actually a hybrid with a brief totality around Iceland, but we were able to see just the beginning and ending partial stages that day. And then the next Saros was in 2004, and what we're seeing here is the page out of a book that predicts that eclipse, my telescope that I'm using, and in the shadow of the telescope, you can see the partially eclipsed sun. So one picture tells the whole story of that eclipse and of that event. And I did say earlier that I love penumbral eclipses of the moon, and I'll even travel to see them, especially when I can get a picture like this, a single picture that shows the Earth's surface, the Earth's shadow, going out into space and hitting the moon that is in penumbral eclipse that time, you can, at that point, you can see the reflection of it. And then in case you don't know what I was looking through, that's an airplane window. March 14th, 2006. Everything that we want to do is based on our National Sharing the Sky Foundation. We want to inspire people to reach for the stars, especially children, to look up at the sky, to enjoy the sky, and to make it part of them. I do want to just show you this little thing from Byron. With all kinds of mechanics and full soon, steam engines will conduct him to the moon. He said that he wrote those words, Byron did, 150 years before Apollo 8 was launched into lunar orbit, Christmas Eve, 1968. And just get the beauty of the night sky almost anywhere, and you can capture it on film or electronically almost anywhere. And that is not a trick out of Photoshop. That is a real owl just sitting there, came there every night for about 2 months, perched himself on top of that pole, and waited for me to take his picture. So I started by talking about the beauty of just looking at the moon and watching what it does and observing how it changes its shape from night to night as it waxes and gets to be full and then starts to wane again. It is the most beautiful thing to do. It is so elegant and so simple, and it needs no instruction. It provides inspiration, which is the whole point of what I'm trying to do. And what I want to do now is to end my presentation by inviting you to join with me for a short while as we take a look at the moon and enjoy its majesty. I just need a minute or so to get the second part of this thing going. This should be. to go to Project Astro and learn all of the little ways of doing it. You just need to have the magic and figure out a way to share that magic with other people. Let them look at the moon. When they're looking through a telescope, make sure that the light from the moon is going through the eyepiece into the eye of the child. That is, to me, the best way of doing that. And I think the more we do that, the more exciting it's going to be for them, and the more exciting it's going to be for us. Because to me, there's probably nothing more enjoyable than taking a child and giving her or him a first look at the universe. I close with a quotation from a poet, an English poet, Ralph Hodgson, who wrote the Song of Honor in 1913. The ending lines go as follows. I stood and stared. The sky was lit. The sky was stars all over it. I stood. I knew not why. Without a wish, without a will, I stood upon that silent hill and stared into the sky until my eyes were blind with stars. And still I stared into the sky. Thank you.
Questions?